In this video, I want to share an English Muslim's guide to Palestine, and I want to share some amazing words from this book, one of my favorite books, Islam and the Destiny of Man, by the English Muslim writer Guy Eaton. Now, Guy Eaton, as many of you will know, was a British diplomat. He was a writer, a consultant at Regent's Park Mosque, not far from where I'm sitting here in London. And I think he was had been a Muslim for 50 years at the time of his death. And if you like, he was bilingual in both languages, the languages of the West and the languages of Islam. So he's uniquely placed to communicate to the West what it means to be a Muslim and the Muslim perspective. And he did that with exemplary brilliance, in my view. And what's interesting about this particular book, which was published in 1997, is how little the situation has changed in the past 25 years. So his insights written in 1997, when the book was published, are still pretty fresh, actually, and highly relevant to today. And that's why I want to share with you his words, words which I find very compelling and insightful. So on page 36 of Islam and the Destiny of Man, he writes the following. The Palestine question is so fraught with emotion that one would be glad to escape the necessity of mentioning it. Necessity, however, cannot be escaped, and the existence of the State of Israel in Palestine, the first territory beyond the Arabian Peninsula to be conquered by Islam, is the key to the political orientation of the vast majority of educated Muslims in our time. The cause of most of the troubles which have afflicted the Arab world over the past 45 years and a constant factor of instability in the Middle East. The United States and the European Union might be less inclined to indulge in wishful thinking on this issue if they understood a little more about the Muslim perspective. In the first place, Muslims do not in general share the Occidental obsession with race. By Occidental, he means the Western obsession with race. Europeans and their American cousins, even when they are quite free from any hostile prejudice, automatically identify people in terms of their racial origin. The Muslim, on the other hand, identifies and judges a man or a woman primarily in terms of their religion. This is a really interesting point here, which Westerners don't often appreciate. A Jew is a faithful adherent of Judaism, just as a Muslim is an adherent of Islam, even if his grandfather happened to be a Jewish rabbi, as was the case with an eminent contemporary writer and scholar, the late Muhammad Asad. And I'm just going to pause there, and I just want to recommend a book by Muhammad Asad called The Road to Mecca. This is a fantastic book, and if you've not come across it before, you've not read it, please do read it. It's a fantastic story of his journey to Islam by a man who had a huge influence on Pakistan and on contemporary Islam in the world, a true genius. So back to the book. As it happens, a surprisingly high proportion of European and American converts to Islam over recent years have been of Jewish origin, no doubt on account of the strong affinities between these two religious perspectives. And the game is something people in the West often don't realize, just how similar Orthodox Judaism is to Islam, particularly in its legal dimension, legal tradition, the halakha and the sharia. What the West sees in Israel is the establishment of a homeland for the Jewish race, just recompense for centuries of persecution at the hands of Europeans. Whether or not the citizens of the new state happen to be individually religious seems quite irrelevant. The Nazis did not inquire into a man's piety before sending him to the gas chamber. What the Muslim sees in Israel is European and American settlers established in a Muslim country with the support of the former imperial powers and maintained there by American arms. And one must today, of course, say that with force of European Union arms, a lot of armory, weaponry comes from the European Union. A secular Jew is, for him, a contradiction in terms. So far as he can judge, most Israelis, particularly those in the ruling group, are not Jews at all. They look like Europeans, they talk like Europeans, they think like Europeans, and most important of all, they exhibit precisely those characteristics of aggressiveness and administrative efficiency, which the Muslim associates with European imperialism. The parallel with the Crusades is painfully obvious. Westerners have again come to Palestine. They again occupy the holy city of Jerusalem. The misfortunes of the Jews as a race, in inverted commas, the pogroms and the Holocaust itself, were certainly not the fault of the Muslims. Europe's guilt is Europe's business, and they do not see why they should be expected to suffer for it. And of course, the vast majority of Germans in National Socialist Germany in the 1930s were committed Lutheran Christians and Roman Catholic Christians, very, very few atheists. So it was very much a Christian country that spearheaded the Holocaust. Why do you not give the Jews some of the choicest lands of Germany? King Abdulaziz ibn Saud asked President Roosevelt. Interesting question. He might well have suggested, no less reasonably, but no more profitably, that the Americans, if they felt so strongly on this subject, could quite well spare one of their own 48 states, Texas, perhaps, as a home for the Jews. The white man, as the Arabs see it, is more inclined to give away other people's territory than his own. Many Muslims are convinced that Western support for Israel can be ascribed quite simply to hypocrisy. They believe that Europe and the United States created Israel as a means of ridding themselves of their Jewish populations. However absurd this accusation may seem to Europeans and Americans, the fact remains that Zionism arose as a reaction to anti-Semitism and, in the view of its founders, needed anti-Semitism. Theodor Herzl himself, he was a father, of course, of Zionism, was not afraid to say that, quote, the anti-Semites will become our surest friends and the anti-Semitic countries our allies, end of quote. Precisely because in his time, prejudice against people of Jewish origin was diminishing and the process of assimilation accelerating, it was all the more necessary to emphasize that Jews were, quote, different and did not really belong in the countries of their adoption, an opinion in which the anti-Semites heartily concurred. Herzl was warned by a friend, the president of the Austrian parliament, no less, that his emphasis upon the separateness of the Jewish people would eventually, quote, bring a bloodbath on Jewry, end quote. 50 years later, it was the Holocaust and the sense of guilt prevailing in Europe and the United States, which could have saved so many lives by an open door policy towards Jewish refugees, that made possible the establishment of the State of Israel. This was made easier by the Palestinians' self-identification as Arabs. It was, and still is, assumed by many people in the West that this is an indication of their racial origin. In Islam, the term Arab is applied to anyone whose first language is Arabic. It tells us nothing about his ancestry. Another, again, the really important point here, often not appreciated in the West, who see Arabs purely in racial terms. That's not Islamic. That's not how Muslims, of course, see the matter. In fact, the Palestinians are descended from the ancient Canaanites, to whose blood, if one must speak in racialist terms, a dozen invading peoples added their quota. Philistines, Hebrews, Greeks, Romans, Persians, Arabs, and Turks, to name but a few. The only point to be made is that the Palestinians are not a people who took possession of the land by force. They were always there. And before I continue with Guyton's book, very interesting point that if you read the Bible, the book of Genesis, the book of Exodus, the Canaanites were already in the land of Canaan. That's what it's called. And according to the Bible today that we have today, God ordered the Israelites to go into the Canaanite nations and races and tribes and exterminate them. And the Bible, for example, in 1 Samuel 15, verses 3 to 4 to 5, read it for yourself. Or apparently, it does have God order the targeted killing of women, children, and babies. These are Canaanite babies and women and children. Why? So the Israelites can move into their land. And this is all there in the Bible. There's many genocides commanded by God in the Bible. I mean, one must point out, of course, that archaeologists, professional archaeologists, looking back at the sedimentary layers back to that time, have found no evidence of genocide. They found no evidence of whole cities or races or nations or tribes slaughtered. There should be some indication in the archaeological record, and there isn't. So the good news is that the genocides, as portrayed in the Bible, it looks like they didn't actually happen. But the text as we have it today, the Bible, nevertheless has been used by settlers in occupied Palestine to justify the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians. And on that subject, I do recommend this book, Ilan Pappe, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. He's actually an Israeli historian. He's now a professor of history at the University of Exeter here in England. And this is a classic work. I do highly recommend it if you want to know the facts. It draws on primary sources, Israeli historians, documentary evidence, which proves beyond doubt that Zionism from its inception intended to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians as a matter of deliberate policy. And this, of course, as we've seen, has echoes in the Bible. But moving on, moving back to the book, Guyton, it's just a couple of paragraphs to go. Finally, Muslims, with their first-hand experience of colonization, can see plainly enough that the notion of settling people from elsewhere in a third world country against the wishes of the indigenous inhabitants could only have arisen in the context of colonialism and as a manifestation of colonialist mentality. Here again, the public statements of the founding fathers of Zionism seem to them to support this view. The Zionist pioneers were necessarily men of their time, and their time was the high noon of imperialism. They shared with their fellow Europeans a set of values and beliefs which justified and even glorified the colonization of Asia and Africa in the worthy cause of bringing civilization to the natives. It is little wonder, for example, that Aaron Aronson, addressing an audience of French colons in Tunisia in 1909, should have drawn attention to the fact that Jewish immigration into Palestine began in exactly the same year as the French colonization of Tunisia, 1882, and compared the Jewish settler in Palestine to the French settler in Tunisia. So clearly the Zionist project was part of a wider European project of colonization of, in very racist terms, of other races and other peoples who had no rights, no independence, no say in what happened at all, just as we see today, of course, with the Palestinians who have no say in their future in the occupied countries, in the occupied territories. For educated Muslims who identify with the Palestinians, the humiliation of being treated as natives could be pushed aside to make room for white men and women, was intensified by the failure of superior Arab forces to dislodge these settlers. This is a common frustration mentioned today, of course, many people frustrated at the lack of military or physical action to rescue the Palestinians from the brutal occupation and genocide they're undergoing at the moment. at the very time when Western imperial power was making a discreet withdrawal elsewhere in the world, they were again forced to recognize their own impotence in the face of this power. Humiliation begets rage, and this rage has now sunk deep roots even in the more distant outposts of the Muslim world, most particularly among the young. Turbulent emotions are not easily analysed, but one has the impression that these young people reserve their most bitter resentment not for the Israelis, but, can you guess, for the Americans. To some extent, they understand that the Israelis act as they themselves might act under similar circumstances. They cannot, however, forgive the nation, but for whose support the state of Israel could not have survived in its present form. But this is not the end of the story. It is only the first item on an agenda of victimization to which Muslims believe they have been subjected over the past half century. Now, of course, three quarters of a century. Recent events in Kashmir and in India itself figure prominently on this agenda, but there are few areas of the world in which Muslims have not had reason to feel persecuted. It is, however, the conflict in what was formerly Yugoslavia through 1992 and 1993 that provided final confirmation of what is commonly seen as a calculated conspiracy. Facts are always open to dispute, but there can be no dispute regarding what people believe to be the facts, and this is what counts. Prior to 1992, those who claimed that Europe and the United States were set upon a new crusade to destroy Islam and enslave the Muslims were a minority and might be considered marginal. Without counting heads, which is impossible, it appears that they may now be in a majority. End quote. So that was written in 1997. And of course, he makes no mention of the Uyghur Muslims in China, because that wasn't an issue then at all. Yugoslavia was very much in his memory just a few years before. So that's a quote from Islam and the Destiny of Man. And as I say, I think what's so interesting about this is how fresh and relevant his words were, written so long ago, a quarter of a century ago, and how little has changed, actually. There are one or two things he could not have predicted, would not have known about, perhaps, and that is the rise of social media and the way that we have direct and very disturbing access to the most appalling and atrocities on our Twitter feed, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok. We can see the killings, the huge numbers of killings that are taking place and continue to happen in the occupied Palestinian, both in the West Bank and in Gaza. So he could not have foreseen that and the impact that's having in the West, actually, where many, many young people, non-Muslims, I mean, are now understanding the realities of the brutal genocidal occupation and are supporting the Palestinians over against the dominant media and government narrative, which, of course, is solidly Zionist in its views. So I just wanted to share an English Muslim's guide to Palestine, which is, as I say, extremely relevant to today's terrible situation. And a friend of mine, who I won't mention his name to spare his embarrassment, just WhatsApped me earlier today, actually, some words we were talking about, you know, the reasons for establishing a Zionist outpost in the Middle East. And he concluded, to paraphrase really, essentially it's the latest version of a crusade by proxy. But the reason he thinks that it's not called that, it's not called a crusade, because historically such actions were, was to avoid triggering a calling for an armed struggle against the crusaders by the Muslim communities worldwide. So, you know, they're trying to sugarcoat, if that's the right word, or conceal yet another crusading ambition in the Muslim world. But don't want to call it that because it might trigger a lot worse a response than it is at the moment from their point of view. So there we are. I just wanted to share that with you. Till next time.